You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
WikiLeaks forever altered American information security when, in 2010, it published the largest leak of classified documents in U.S. history. Over 6 months, it provided access to 250,000 diplomatic cables and war logs from Afghanistan and Iraq. The technology that made it possible has been decades in the making and continues to become more advanced. Forbes magazine tech writer Andy Greenberg met with the world's most prominent internet activist to chronicle the rise of this technology and the drive behind it. His book, This Machine Kills Secrets, How WikiLeakers, Cypherpunks, and Hacktivists Aim to Free the World's Information, is published by Dutton. I'm very pleased it brings Mr. Greenberg to our show today. Hello.
Very glad to be here. Thanks.
And you sat down with Julian Assange 3 weeks before the WikiLeaks release of hundreds of thousands of U.S. diplomatic cables, now been dubbed Cablegate. Everything gets a gate. What was Assange like at that time?
Well, I was struck by both how kind of nerdy he was, but also charming, and how he seemed to wield this power very comfortably. He was he had just gotten used to having this power to sort of just push a button and dump troves of corporate and government secrets, and he made it seem so easy.
Was it easy to get in contact with him?
Well, it just involves talking to a lot of intermediaries and kind of winning their trust. It started with some instant messaging conversations I had with a guy in Iceland who went by the name Penguin X, this pseudonymous WikiLeaks staffer in Reykjavik. And so I went there and I met him and a bunch of other lesser-known WikiLeaks folks and sort of hung out waiting for Assange to tell me where he was, actually. Nobody knew what city he was in, and he wouldn't tell me where we were going to meet. And finally, it turned out to be London. And so I hopped on a plane to London and had this three-hour meeting where he kind of laid it all out for me.
So he's pretty open.
Well, he's open about certain things, and this is the great paradox that Assange is all about freedom of information, and yet he's always a semi-opaque figure. And he told me at the time that there was going to be a WikiLeaks' biggest release ever in just a matter of weeks, but he wouldn't tell me what it was. He just told me that it was going to be 7 times the size of the Iraq war logs, and it turned out to be the Cablegate's 250,000 secret State Department cables.
He also suggested that there was going to be a leak about a major American bank,
right?
Suspected to be Bank of America. Did that ever come out?
Well, similarly, he said he wouldn't say what bank it was, and he wouldn't say what it contained, but he hinted that it was going to be explosive and take down a bank or two. That was a quote. And that never appeared. And,
But it did have an impact on the stock market.
Absolutely. The Bank of America, when the rumors started going around, and there was good reason to believe that the bank was Bank of America, lost $3.5 million in its total stock value in a matter of hours. And I spent the next year trying to figure out what happened to these bank documents because they weren't ever actually released by WikiLeaks.
And why do you think that is? Does he have a line that he won't cross?
I don't think so. I think if he had them, he would have absolutely published them, unless they were just boring, which he clearly did not believe was the case. He told me that they were explosive, that they were going to, expose unethical behavior on this grand scale. The story is more complicated than that.
But still, you say that Cablegate changed the world.
That I do believe. I mean, the bank documents were lost in this kind of infighting and intrigue within WikiLeaks, but Cablegate was their grand hacktivist coup that I think was, it was the biggest release of classified documents to the public ever. And I believe it did have ripples that caused the Tunisian Revolution and other major political movements around the world.
You said that he struck you as kind of nerdy. What was he like as a young man?
Well, Assange, when he was a teenager, was a traditional hacker who was breaking into the Pentagon and major Silicon Valley corporations from Australia and part of this hacker underground. I mean, I've spoken with hackers more recently who knew him as a kind of legendary figure, and they knew him as Mendex, this pseudonymous hacker from the mid-90s. And I think that kind of hacker mentality, although he doesn't like to call himself a hacker anymore, that absolutely shaped his thinking and helped to lead to WikiLeaks.
He was particularly good at what hackers call social engineering. What's that?
Well, that's simply calling somebody up and getting them to tell you their secrets. So, I describe in the book this one incident. He actually, he wrote a kind of autobiography that wasn't labeled as such at the time. He was the research assistant on this book about Australian hackers, and one of the characters turned out to be him, but he never told anybody until years later. And he describes how he, you know, he broke into one of a major Australian firm simply just by calling up one of the operators and giving him this long story about how, you know, a storage database had been wiped and he needed to you know, have a password for one of his clients. So that's something that the hackers traditionally do. But Assange, you know, he's a very charming guy and he knows how to work the system, as we see even today.
And did he tell you what motivated him to found WikiLeaks?
Well, what I trace in the book is how after his years as a, you know, as a fugitive hacker, he fell in with this group called the Cypherpunks, you know, that's in the title of the book. This mid-90s movement that wanted to use encryption and anonymity software to take power away from governments and give it to individuals.
How is that any different than what Anonymous does?
Well, Anonymous absolutely is an offshoot of this. I think that Anonymous, you know, whether they're aware of it or not, are absolutely the stepchildren of the Cypherpunks. You know, but Assange is more than a stepchild. He was one of them. He took these ideas of making information untraceable, or making payments untraceable, or leaked secrets untraceable, and using that as a weapon against authority.
Well, he sought to change the nature of government by creating a leaking revolution. He just wanted to make everything transparent. He took it upon himself to do that.
I think so. I mean, he's been the smartest guy in the room his entire life, and I think he had, I'm not sure I would call them illusions of grandeur, but he had visions of grandeur that he was going to be the kind of messiah of free information. I don't know if you can go that far, but he certainly believed in his ability to change the world.
How does he respond to criticism that WikiLeaks has put innocent people in danger?
Well, he would point to the fact that there has been no confirmed death or injury to anybody exposed in WikiLeaks cables. Of course, that's really difficult to know. I would not necessarily make that claim myself or say that what WikiLeaks has released was all responsible. But in late 2011, WikiLeaks accidentally released the unredacted State Department cable database, which was a really huge slip-up and led to the exposure of many State Department sources, who included journalists who ought to have been Assange's allies in this free information movement.
But you said that you think he doesn't think any secrets are worth keeping, although obviously they do withhold some.
Well, I would say that actually Assange has never believed in absolute freedom or absolute anti-secrecy. I think that he believes that something should remain secret, such as the identity of the sources that give him the information.
So his stated mission is to promote truth and openness in government, but not necessarily when in himself.
Well, that's the seeming paradox, is that WikiLeaks has always believed in personal privacy and tried to destroy institutional secrecy. I think those are two different things. As we saw, you know, WikiLeaks has always attempted to protect the identity of its sources. That was its sort of secret ingredient. And that was really what allowed it to destroy institutional secrecy on a greater scale than ever before.
So how did Bradley Manning's name come?
Well, that's the thing. That seems to have been almost a fluke that he or not a fluke, but not a technological issue, that he simply told another hacker. I mean, Bradley Manning was a lonely kid, ostracized from his military colleagues and looking for a friend. And he ended up confessing his crimes to someone he barely knew on the Internet who exposed him.
My guest is Andy Greenberg of Forbes magazine. His book, This Machine Kills Secrets, How WikiLeakers, Cypherpunks, and Hacktivists Aim to Free the World's Information. When was the last time you were in touch with Assange? Obviously before he went into the Ecuadorian embassy. Or
right.
Have you spoken to him on the phone?
The last time I spoke to him on the phone was in March of last year, and he called me up on my cell phone to basically yell at me about a story I'd written. Part of what I've tried to chronicle is I've been looking for the next WikiLeaks. I mean, I think WikiLeaks is not the organization it once was. It's kind of been paralyzed by his legal troubles and other issues. So I've been looking at the spinoffs and copycats trying to do what WikiLeaks did, and one of them was the group that kind of mutinied within WikiLeaks and went off to start their own organization. And Assange didn't like what I'd written about them.
We're going to go to a break in just a moment, but do you think WikiLeaks is kind of dead now?
I think that they're on life support.
My guest is Andy Greenberg. This Machine Kills Secrets is published by Dutton. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Andy Greenberg, staff writer for Forbes magazine and author of This Machine Kills Secrets, How WikiLeakers, Cypherpunks, and Hacktivists Aim to Free the World's Information. It's published by Dutton. Where does the title come from?
Well, I always thought of WikiLeaks as this kind of machine where you simply like turn a crank and secrets come pouring out of it. That was the brilliance of Assange's invention. But then I in my home neighborhood in Brooklyn, I saw a guy playing a guitar with Woody Guthrie's slogan on it, "This machine kills fascists." And I thought about that and saw how that kind of connects this protest movement that's, you know, WikiLeaks is a kind of activist machine that used cryptography and anonymity to spill secrets on a scale no one had ever seen before.
And as you pointed out, Assange was just one of a number of people who were called cypherpunks, all men, it seems. Why is that?
Just about. I mean, I think there's – well, partly there's a certain fact that, you know, most geeks are men, and these guys were very technical. A lot of them were former Silicon Valley engineers, but also they were a very angry group. You know, there was a certain, like, anti-authoritarian anger about their goals.
But we normally think of them as being on the left. Many of them are not.
Well, yeah, I think they were an interesting mix. I mean, some of them, such as the founder of Cryptome, a kind of early leaking site based in New York, actually. The founder of that site was very far to the left. His name is John Young, and he participated in the occupation of Columbia University in 1968. But then there were also, I think the group was dominated by very, very libertarian individuals.
Ayn Rand libertarians?
I would say so. I mean, they might say the character in the book who I focus on the most thinks of Ayn Rand as kind of like an oversimplified version of libertarianism. But he absolutely was affected by her ideas. That's Tim May, who founded the cypherpunks and then went on to use the cypherpunks' ideas to create something called Blacknet, which was a very, very early idea of a way to untraceably leak secrets onto the internet.
And untraceable is important in all of this.
Absolutely, yeah.
Jim Bell of the cypherpunks theorized assassination politics. What's that?
Well, he was, I would say, maybe the most extreme of these, in many ways, of the cypherpunks libertarians. He wanted to create a system, or simply, he's never gone so far as to say, let's build this, but he's proposed it in a way like, let's just think about this idea of using untraceable payments so that anybody can, put a dollar onto the head of a politician, and if enough money is untraceably pooled together through some kind of cryptographic currency that at the time didn't even quite exist, but does more so today, then maybe we can assemble enough money to pay a hitman to go kill somebody. So this was – the idea was it was a kind of
– Was he suggesting any victims, any targets?
The idea was to crowdsource the suggestion of victims. It would be a kind of digital Deadpool where anybody can contribute almost the same way that we – like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, these sites that, you know, crowdfund charitable things now – but they would fund assassinations instead. And he believed that this was going to change government around the world forever.
And it is illegal, but only made possible by the fact that you can remain pretty much anonymous on the internet. I thought everything was traceable if you really knew how to do it.
Well, I think that by default, everything on the internet is traceable, as you say, is not private. But the cypherpunks were inspired by tools like PGP, a email encryption piece of software that even the government can't crack this encryption and read your email. And then it developed from there into not just hiding the contents of the data, but hiding the data's source, you know, by encrypting information and then passing it through multiple computers around the internet so that it can't be traced. And if you use these tools, that does defy the fundamental publicness of the internet. I think you can actually have a kind of anonymity that is very hard to achieve in the offline world.
In the early stages of the internet, the men you call the cryptographers theorized that the internet would allow governments to spy on the citizens in a way that never was possible before. Has that been the case? And more important for this conversation, is that why they felt that they had to somehow push back?
I think so. The PGP software that I just mentioned, invented by Phil Zimmerman. Phil saw email as just basically a postcard. You know, it's this letter that's fundamentally readable by anybody in the chain. It's as if you just allow the post office to just read all of your letters. And so he wanted to create a tool that basically allowed you to seal your letters. That's all. But it became so controversial because not even the federal government was able to open those letters. You know, it was secret on a level that the government had never seen before, and he was actually investigated and nearly put in prison for creating this.
Did these people see Daniel Ellsberg and the release of the Pentagon Papers as the pioneering act?
I think Assange absolutely does, and others in the leaking movements. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg is kind of the archetypal leaker.
But he uses Xeroxes.
Right, yeah. Well, in the first chapter of the book, I try to contrast Bradley Manning, the alleged source of the WikiLeaks cables, and Daniel Ellsberg. And the clearest difference is simply just the nature of information now. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg spent 3 solid months over the course of a year in front of a photocopier duplicating the Pentagon Papers, whereas Bradley Manning was able to sort of liquidly just spill many orders of magnitude more information with very little effort.
In the case of Daniel Ellsberg, he just was shocked by all the secrets around the Vietnam War. But you get the feeling here that this is not just a matter of people trying to do the right thing.
I believe that Bradley Manning thought he was doing the right thing. But he was a troubled kid, and the fact is that it was just so easy. I think that that's a big part of why he was why he spilled so much more. I mean, that Daniel Ellsberg not only knew what he was leaking, he had written a lot of it himself, and it was simply top secret classified, so it was illegal for him to share it. Bradley Manning, I think, read only a tiny fraction of what he leaked, and that's, you know, a scary thing, and that's kind of the nature of whistleblowing now. There's so much more information available to a potential leaker, and you know, it's even WikiLeaks wasn't even aware of exactly what they were releasing.
Who are the hacktivists? Is the world of hacking still as vibrant today as it was during the early years of the internet?
I think it's more vibrant than ever, and partly inspired by WikiLeaks and the ideas of the cypherpunks that are bubbling up to, you know, the kind of public consciousness now. You see this group Anonymous, a kind of movement of hackers who use cypherpunk tools to, you know, to hide their identities. And they're more active and not just hacking things for themselves. I mean, Assange in the late 80s and 90s was hacking into corporations and governments. And it was kind of just something he did with his friends. But Anonymous, partly inspired by WikiLeaks, they want to leak this stuff. They want to publish it on the internet. And in early 2011, Anonymous created something called Anon Leaks, where they made a searchable database of the emails of a security firm that they had hacked. And that was a scandalous thing that made what they'd found within that firm much more easily parsable by journalists like me.
It was theorized, it was rumored that the recent bring down of GoDaddy was done by hackers, but it's not clear that it was. But is it important? I guess it's important that people even immediately think that hackers might have done something like that.
Well, I mean, there's a degree to which hackers have become just bogeymen who are responsible for everything that goes wrong online. But you know, that's part of the difficulty of this is that everything is very difficult to attribute and trace and Anonymous, especially, who are just really a kind of anarchical group of kids half the time who have these technical abilities and no ideology or a very loose ideology, it's tough to pin down whether what they've released is credible. And you know, somebody, I believe a hacker did actually claim credit for that GoDaddy hack, but there was no evidence of that.
There seems to be a constant struggle between the hacktivists and the cypherpunks and government agencies. Is it continuing today, and is there an apparent winner?
I think that it's a cat and mouse game, and what WikiLeaks showed was that there's a kind of a new game about insider leakers and the government agencies that would like to catch them. And with WikiLeaks, the mice absolutely showed that they were far, far ahead of the cats. You know, And now we see a backlash where the military, for instance, is trying to come up with software to identify leakers before or after the fact. And the Obama administration has indicted more leakers under the Espionage Act than any other president combined.
Do hackers ever switch sides?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a very key member of Anonymous who turned out to have been a government informant for more than a year and exposed many of his, you know, Anonymous colleagues. I think that has, and that absolutely sows a kind of paranoia into the whole movement that is part of what helped to paralyze WikiLeaks.
If Julian Assange eventually winds up in Ecuador, will he just be able to carry on as he did before, or is it important that we know where he is?
I think that Assange, as long as he's got an internet connection, will be able to carry on his work. I think there's another question about whether he is his reputation is intact. The accidental leak of the WikiLeaks State Department database in late 2011 was a big blow to WikiLeaks' credibility. I think not credibility, but necessarily, but its professionalism, its duty to to release information responsibly. Also, the fact that Assange has hosted a talk show on a Russian government-funded television network, I think, betrays a lot of his ideals. You know, the Russian government is no friend to journalists, as we all know.
You wrote about some of the world's most prominent hackers. Were you ever afraid of being hacked yourself?
I remain afraid of being hacked every day. I think it's only—
Do you know whether you have been?
I guess I haven't been, as far as I know, but that's even scarier in a way. Every time that I get my password wrong and I'm momentarily locked out of an account, I feel like, oh, it's finally happened. They've changed my password and gotten in, you know. But it hasn't happened to my knowledge. It's just a kind of fear that I think every security journalist has to live with today.
Do you use anonymizing software yourself?
I did to experiment with it for the book, and I also did to communicate with some of the people in the book who insisted that I do that. I think it's important, actually, that every journalist know how to use that, or more importantly, that they know how to teach their sources to use it. I mean, anonymity is really in the hands of the source. It's up to the source to maintain their own security. And I think that journalists should know how to use encryption and know how to use anonymity tools like Tor. But it's most important that when they're dealing with a sensitive source, they teach the source, because that's the person at risk, obviously.
Can I just buy some anonymizing software?
It's easier than that. Tor is free to download. And it's
so I could just download it on my computer, and from then on I could send out all sorts of nasty little messages and people won't know that it was me?
That's what I would say Anonymous, the hacker group, is all about.
I'm not very good at working the computer. Maybe my staff can do that for me. Can you get on that job right now?
But, you know, more importantly, I mean, Tor isn't just used for sending nasty grams around the internet. It's also used for bypassing censorship and surveillance in countries like Iran and China and, you know, lots of authoritarian regimes. And that's the thing about this idea of anonymity. We can't sort of just ban it. We can't say Tor was actually created by the U.S. government for open source intelligence by the military. And for it to work, it has to allow anybody to use it. Otherwise, it'd be very easy to identify, oh, somebody's using this software, they must be from the military. So it's kind of this paradox that we have to allow, you know, lots of trolls and hackers and bad guys to use Tor so that it can be useful for the people who really need it.
And it's not crackable?
That's up for debate. You know, I would say that anybody who claims that their encryption or their anonymity tool is uncrackable is probably selling you something. But Tor has been hammered on by the security community more than any other anonymity tool, absolutely. And you know, that's really what makes things more secure. I think it's the most secure anonymity and anonymous way of browsing the web.
So as long as we continue using the internet as a way of communicating, should we assume that these things will continue and people get more sophisticated about how to do these things?
I think so. I mean, Tor is becoming a more powerful tool over time as more people run these relays around the internet. Tor is the idea is that you bounce the traffic through many different relays. And the more relays there are, the more secure Tor becomes. And there are other tools being invented. And there are other even veins in this transparency movement technologically that continue to grow. Like, one interesting one is the idea of recording things with your smartphone in person and leaking that to the internet the way that we just saw happen to Romney earlier this week. You know, there's so many different branches, but anonymity itself is becoming more powerful too.
Well, there have been suggestions that what happened to Romney was illegal. How much of this activity is illegal? Is pretty much all of it?
Well, I would say that the brilliant thing about WikiLeaks and groups that want to replicate what it did is that they create this cryptographic barrier between the illegal behavior and the public behavior. So you just can't trace the illegal part of it. What WikiLeaks did, you know, I think was legal. And if Assange is indicted for hacking or a conspiracy or something, then you know, it's going to be an epic battle for First Amendment rights, I think.
Andy Greenberg is a staff writer for Forbes. His book, This Machine Kills Secrets, How WikiLeakers, Cypherpunks, and Hacktivists Aim to Free the World's Information, is published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.